Support for KMUW's Into Music podcast comes from McClelland, reminding listeners that Frank Sinatra coined the word skibbity in Strangers in the Night, which you can listen to in their downtown Wichita showroom. More info on McClelland's innovative sound, lighting, and video technology can be found at maxsound.com.
Hi, I'm Jed Budwin, and you're listening to Into Music from the KMUW studios, part of the NPR Podcast Network. My guest on this episode is Irish singer-songwriter Alva Reddy, whose new album, Kiss Big, is out now. The record has its origins in the end of a romantic relationship and the various emotions that arose in the emotional wake. We discuss the inspiration for the songs, as well as Reddy's musical history, the connection she has with her audience, and the song from Kiss Big that began simply enough, but soon became the record's emotional center. That's Alva Reddy on Into Music, coming up now. So what was kind of the genesis of this?
Well, I guess I was going through, it's very classic, going through a big breakup, and I kind of went through all the breakup tropes, you know, moving to a different city, getting a severe haircut, trying to become a very different person really, really quickly, you know, almost that impulse to, if you met the person, other person walking down the street 6 months later, that you could wow them by being so incredibly different, on the outside at least. It started off around then, and I just kind of went through this massive change period where I left Dublin, moved to London, met all new people. And I guess I started writing it around then. And I probably wrote about 20 songs. And it was only when we started recording them that I started seeing this really clear start period of this kind of wishing the other person well, to going through a period of like love doesn't exist and I'll never feel that way about anyone again, and then ending up kind of finding myself back in it again and realizing that love is this kind of cyclical thing that we're always all reaching out for.
Well, that part that you mentioned, you know, about you know, the trope of getaway and, you know, move to a different town, isn't it funny when we go through that kind of thing, you know, at the end of a romantic relationship, how much we try to shed of who we were and where we were. It's like to a person, right? You can always see it.
Yeah. And I think it's, I was thinking recently about what that impulse is. And I really think it's this trying to move. And some of the songs on the album, like That Girl, which it's about trying to get as far away from that relationship as possible, not even in a bad way, but more just for yourself to kind of fast forward the grief process. A little bit, at least externally speaking, to make it seem like you're so far away from it, when really the only thing that can do that is time.
It's funny because the last time that this happened for me, I moved like to a neighborhood where I knew I wouldn't know anybody and I wouldn't go to like any of the stores, you know. It's like I can't possibly run into anybody. And it was like also very liberating, because it was like I didn't want to answer questions or talk about things or anything like that. I just wanted to be me, you know?
Yeah, exactly. You get to exit it in some sort of surface way, at least. Like your mind might still be spinning on it, but yeah, so I wrote a big massive collection of songs and just found this thread of disconnection and reconnection, and how we're always seeking that. I studied psychotherapy in college, and I think I'm kind of obsessed with how we repeatedly choose the same patterns. You know, we go for similar people, we seek out the same things, we're frustrated by the same things over and over and over again, and that you can end up back at it again and actually just lean into it and enjoy the ups and downs as much as possible.
There are moments too where it seems like some of what you're reflecting on is those things that when we're first getting to know somebody or we've just met them, the things that we appreciate and the things that draw us together. And then it's like, at some point, those are gone. And you're like, oh, am I ever going to find somebody I don't argue with when I go on a trip?
Yeah, or someone who I find their like morning routine really fascinating. Or and you will, probably. Or I'm quite like, you know, I'm only 34. So I think that you will again and again, or at least seek those kind of things out. And watching the other person that you, I suppose it's like about ending the relationship that you thought was going to be the relationship, and stopping believing in that, and then realizing like you're kind of back in that relationship again, like it, but another one. And all those like little moments of things, like you said, right? Like the last two songs are very much about those little tiny things that you do at the beginning of a relationship.
Yeah, and I think probably we also in that process we go through those moments maybe of anger or something, and then we come back to, but yeah, weren't they just hysterical?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And the kind of wanting to take the high ground and really be really magnanimous about a breakup, like, I wish you well and everything, but having these moments of, oh my God, how are you already living with someone else? How are you already, like, doing all these things? How are you already, like, buying a house with your new partner when I'm just living in a house share in Hackney?
So what also impressed me though is I didn't feel like, as we're going through it, I didn't feel like we were hitting all the kind of cliches about breakups. So how did you kind of navigate around that? Because I'm guessing at some point there was probably just like a blah on the page of raw emotion, right?
For sure. I mean, I wrote most of the songs the first summer that I was living in London, and I had a little tiny desk. I was living in a tiny room, and I had a little tiny desk up against the wall beside my bed, like a really cramped room. And it was like a crazy heat wave, so I had the doors open, and it was loads of city sounds. And I remember really well just like sitting at the end of my bed playing these songs and trying to record raw versions of them. And yeah, like I said, like maybe 18, 20 songs, and carving them down, pulling back the more melodramatic ones, figuring out which ones kind of told a story that people might want to hear, and a story that felt real to me, which was that I am someone who will always seek out love, I guess. I think we all are. I think it's the thing that really connects us, and that's why when you hear a breakup song, you get it. When you hear a love song, you get it.
What then about when you went in to record it? Were there certain things that you were thinking like in terms of the settings for the songs and the mood that you wanted to capture? Was there a lot of thought about that before you went into the studio?
Yeah, I'd been listening to a lot of songs that I used to listen to when I was a teenager that had this kind of folk electronica, analog synths mixed with acoustic guitar and drum beats mixed with acoustic kits. And I really wanted it to have that vibe. So any of the songs that went too far into the more slacker indie pop thing that I had been doing, I tried to steer away from. There's still a hint of that in some of them because that's just the world that I'm from. And there's still hints of folk everywhere, obviously, because that's where I'm from. But I wanted to keep this kind of like bedroom poppy, like analog synth sound. That was a really conscious decision for me. And I guess it was because those are the so kind of songs that I heard when I was a teenager that I loved. And I wanted to write something that I kind of, it was the first album that I worked on where I wasn't taking in what was big right now. I think if I had, I might have done a country album, but I was more just thinking like, what's the song that, what's the album that I wanted to hear? And that was it.
So not only had you undergone these kind of like emotional changes, you went through a geographical change, but the aesthetic was also changing.
Totally. And I had just done an album with a big label and had found that process, I mean, this isn't groundbreaking to say, I found that process really, really difficult. The kind of disconnect between you and the people who listen to your music becomes really heightened when you're working with a big label. And I wanted to make everything feel smaller and more intimate again because I really missed that DIY kind of vibe of working with the people that you are working with and working in studio with friends who you care about and who care about you and you've worked with all along the way, and playing shows with those friends and playing at venues that are independent and talking to people after shows, that you can kind of end up being in a place where you're separated from all that. And all I wanted was to kind of come back to that because that's the bit that everyone starts at and actually likes.
Well, and I think with very, very few exceptions, even those who have that summer or two where they're playing the big rooms, eventually everybody comes back to it.
Totally. Yeah, exactly. I totally agree with that. You see it all the time. Like, I've been fans of really big bands that have ended up playing smaller rooms again. I love seeing smaller room acts anyway. So it's kind of that realization, what is it that I like? about music? What is it that draws me to a musician? And it's usually just like good songs, nice vibe, and if, you know, I think that person cares about the music.
You touch on something too, which is that I feel like, especially right now, it's really super important for artists to connect with their fans directly these days, that they're coming out to the, for instance, the merch table or, you know, whatever it is, or playing those smaller rooms, because, you know, you have to somehow establish a loyalty with them in some way.
Totally. And also, I mean, there's this kind of funny with Spotify and Ticketmaster prices and everything, not to get too into the weeds with that at all, because everybody talks about it all the time. But my view on it is there's always this sense that people are acting as if fans don't want to pay. And I'm like, I see the exact opposite. Fans are so generous with their time, their attention, their wallets. People are paying more to engage with more music than ever before. I think it's like very unfair because artists and fans are, we actually all want the same thing. We want more music out there. We want to see great stuff being made, and realized and fostered. It's all the in-between companies that separate us and say, oh, fans just don't want to pay that money. And it's, I think that's so unfair. I mean, I don't know if I'm going off piste here with that, but I have experienced fans just being so generous. I did a tour in Ireland 2 years ago of just smaller independent venues and was just blown away by the generosity of people. And this is after coming off the back of doing huge shows, you know, as a support act all over Europe and doing loads of shows in the UK, US, around Europe and everything of varying sizes. And I decided to do this just off my own bat. I booked it myself, went around, just wanted to kind of reconnect with the smaller shows and was just blown away by people's generosity and not just the people attending the shows, but also the people putting on the shows who own a bookshop, maybe in the west of Ireland, and you know, sell a bit of wine and put on a few shows, or own a small bar where they put on something small. Like that stuff is the lifeblood of the music industry. That's where everyone starts out. And like you said, it's usually where people finish out too.
Yeah, I mean, just on that pricing thing, there was an artist who I saw recently, and they made a social media post and said, you know, the tour didn't make money. I think if we would just charged $5 more or something. And I was like, I would have paid $10 more because you gave me so much as an audience member, you know? I felt like I was cheating you for the low price I paid to get in.
And also I think, you know, I see tickets prices as a fan. I'm like, God, that's so expensive now. And it does, it makes me pause because, you know, we're times are tough or whatever. And I don't ever want to put on a show that I think is too expensive for people. And, you know, tickets used to just be the ticket price. Everyone walked into the room and everyone, by and large, was kind of on the same level. And now it feels like there's all this tiered stuff. And I don't like the idea that I'm not in a place where I would be able to do any of that anyway, so I guess it's a moot point. But you know, sometimes I'll do the odd small show that's, you know, a ticket for 10 bucks or $5 or whatever, just because I think it's so important to have that. And accessibility, you know, especially for younger people, having the ability to go to gigs and actually inform taste and maybe decide you want to do it yourself is not possible if you're paying $100 a pop.
Well, and in the small rooms, I wonder if you experience this as a performer. I've kind of given up on the big rooms because eventually somebody has been overserved and they sit behind me at the end of the evening. And I just don't see that like in the small rooms, you know? It's like people are aware why they're there. They're there to see this person and respect the person on stage.
100%. Even like, you know, it's the difference between 20 engaged listeners and 2,000 not. I've definitely done both and I know which gig I prefer. But I know Lily Allen for her tour, the her London show, which you would expect, she is doing bigger shows now, but the first run of shows she did were all in 2.5 cap venue. Two and a half thousand, sorry. And I thought that was really cool because she obviously is just someone who also prefers a smaller club sized venue.
But that seems like a good way of thinking about it, where you kind of build, you know who your audience is, you kind of become reliant, you maybe see some of the same faces over time. If new people come in the door, that's nice, but it's not like you're going to have 1 year where it's, you know, 10 million records, and then the next year it's only 1 million and it's a huge disappointment.
I mean, I'd be happy with 1,000 records, but yeah, exactly. I mean, I think, yeah, just the connection between fans and musicians, that's where it actually starts, and that's where people often lose sight of it when other people come into the mix, when companies come into the mix and start getting involved. I think you can often lose sight of why you're doing it.
So when you started writing songs and playing out, did you have it in mind that this was going to be something that you were going to pursue as a career, or was it just kind of like you kept playing gigs, people kept coming back, and next thing you knew, you were doing tours or something?
It's funny. It's a great question. I was thinking about this because I listened to your interview with Connie Keane from Mail, and I was thinking about my start in it, and that Ireland had just come out of, I mean, as we all had was just coming out of a recession. So I'd gone to college to do teaching. I was going to be a teacher, and I was going to do something that was, I would get a job, and that would be my life job, and a wonderful job, very important job. And I decided to start playing a few gigs just coming out of college, and one gig came to the next gig, and I felt like every gig I played, I got offered something else. And I was very, very shy, so I only started playing when I was about 21 in public. That was the age I was for my first gig, and kept getting offered stuff. And then I put up a demo online of a song that I'd written, and someone from Irish Radio heard it and put it in an ad. And then from that, I got more gig offers and festival offers. And then I ended up being on a TV show, this great TV show called Other Voices. And everything just like went from there. I ended up with management and label and publisher and lawyer and all these people kind of stepping in. And I was quite young still. And it just being this whirlwind where then I realized, like, oh, I can actually do this. This is an option. It was never something that I thought was actually an option for me.
So that must have been a little bit dizzying at some point, where it's like a couple of years ago, I was thinking about what I was going to do in the classroom, and now I'm talking about.
Yeah. And I remember I had gone in for an interview with a school principal, and I got offered a job, and I remember leaving and being like, oh, I should take that job. That's what I've been working towards. And then I also had the opportunity to go and do some shows in the UK, and I didn't take the job because I was like, I know that I'll just stay in that job. But it was really scary to me. And that was the decision I made, and here I am. I don't think either decision was bad or either decision was a right or wrong, but I'm glad that I took the one that I did because the life experiences that I've had have been incredible, and I've met people. And I think one of the best things about being a musician who tours is the people you meet are just so special.
Well, and you have more autonomy in what happens than you do in a classroom, because there's autonomy in the classroom, but it ends at a certain point.
Totally. There is a curriculum that you have to stick to. But it was just such a funny moment when I think back on it that I had this thing that I'd been working towards and this thing that I n thought I could never achieve, which was being a working musician. And it happened all at the same time. Like, kind of this meant to be kind of moment of me deciding, do I take this job or do I go ahead and take the leap?
So you kind of touched on this a little bit earlier, but because I think you mentioned, this time out, not necessarily like following something. So was that also something early on? Do you see like a split of like when you listen back, maybe sometime to early music where you're like, I hadn't found my voice yet, or my voice was just starting to emerge? What was that process like for you?
It's funny, I was always writing songs from when I was a little kid. And then I got a guitar and I begged my parents for a guitar over and over. I'm the youngest of four, so they kept saying, oh, you'll give up guitar if we give it to you, because your sister we bought her a guitar and she gave it up. So I started teaching myself, and then they said, okay, she's serious about this. And I started playing, immediately started writing songs about breakups I'd never been through. I'd never even kissed anybody. I was like 11. All really melodramatic songs about life experiences I had never had. And I guess when I think back on the early songs that I recorded, I used to have a little 8-track. It's like, oh, that kid's got potential. And I guess it always came from a folk focus point of view. I loved, Bob Dylan. I also loved Jeff Buckley was a huge influence of mine when I was a kid. I was obsessed with him. And Yeah, I think it's probably not changed that much. I feel like the album that I'm putting out now is closer to that than my second album. I feel like my first album, the album that I'm putting out now are closer together than the album that I put out in the middle, which felt like a bit of a learning curve.
Did your family or any of your friends think it was strange that you were listening to Bob Dylan and Jeff Buckley as like a 12-year-old or whatever?
I was such a weird kid. I got invited to a sleepover when I was 10, and everyone was told to bring their favorite CD, and I brought Don McLean. And yeah, I brought Don McLean, and everyone else brought like Robbie Williams and Pop Boyzone and all the kind of pop acts of the time, and Britney Spears and everything. All great, but was not my bag. And everyone just was like, who brought the weird CD? So yes, people did think I was strange, and I was. Who wants to be normal?
This is relatable because I can remember times like in elementary school where my peers were listening to like Michael Jackson and Culture Club, and I don't know if you know the Canadian songwriter Gordon Lightfoot.
Oh, I love him. I was obsessed with him at that age too. If you
Okay,
could
so
read my mind, love.
Wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald. A song about a ship sinking. That was my contribution to.
That was your jam.
Yeah.
I totally actually had the last laugh on the Don McLean thing, because about a year after that sleepover where everyone was teasing me, Madonna did her cover of American Pie. And all of a sudden, American Pie was cool.
There you go. So you just got to wait it out. So coming back to this record, when you've lived with it for a while, and then it's going to have this life where the fans hear it, and maybe people who hadn't heard you before start hearing it and stuff. How is that process for you? Like once you start getting feedback, and once it starts hitting people, do you get nervous at all or anything?
I get nervous about critical feedback, obviously, because that can hurt, but actually not as much anymore. Usually when someone criticizes, I'm like, yeah, fair enough. Or sometimes I agree with them, and sometimes I'm like, no, I don't agree with that. But when it comes to fans listening to it, I think my favorite thing about being a musician is when you put a song out into the wild, it stops being yours and becomes everybody else's. Everybody projects their idea of what happened to you or what's going on with them onto it. I think that is the closest thing that you can come to magic. Like, it's this insane connection that you meet someone who will bring up a song that you wrote like 7 years ago and say, oh, I was listening to that during this time and it helped me through X, Y, and Z. And they have this totally separate story than what you had. I think that is so incredible. I love that. It becomes this community piece as opposed to just yours. It's much less lonely.
Yeah, isn't it interesting? Because like I definitely have music that I've done that with, and there was a piece recently where I found myself starting to read the words of this song that I've known for a long time, and then I stopped myself because I was like, obviously this song is not about how I've processed it, and I don't want to understand what it's really about. I just want to have my interpretation.
I know, when you read some or you listen to a song, a beloved song, and you think it's about this one thing, and then you happen across an article years later where it's about something else, and you feel so cheated. Like, the mystery is part of it. Now that you're able to look up what the lyrics are and you can go on Genius and figure out what the meaning is, it kind of sucks, because when I was a kid, it was like you bought the CD or whatever, and you took out the lyric sheet, and that's the If you didn't have that, then you had no idea what it was. It was just whatever you're projecting onto it.
Yeah, the one of the bigger disappointments was the Tears for Fears song Shout, which came out when I was, going through all that stuff you go through with your parents, and that song was really, and they're like, "Oh no, it's about the arms race." And I was like, "Oh."
But isn't it a little bit about me and my parents?
Yeah.
Totally get you, yeah. Or you think that it's a love song and it's actually not about that, or you think it's a love song about another person and it turns out it's someone with their parents as well. Like, as in, I love that is my favorite bit about music, is other people taking what they think out of the song, like taking their own meaning from it and making it theirs a bit. I think that is so cool.
you must have too when records come out or you've been touring for a while. There's like that, I don't know how else to refer to it, maybe like a sleeper song, maybe a song that you hadn't anticipated connecting in the way that it does. And then you're like, oh my gosh, I didn't realize this was going to have that kind of power.
I mean, actually, the second last song on the record and the title of the record now, the record is going to be called something else. It's called Kiss Big. It's just a, you know, one take vocal and guitar. And I had written it as kind of a joke for my partner, as just kind of like a sweet little thing. And then I was playing a show in Paris and my keyboard wasn't working. So I decided to just play that song at the end. I couldn't think of anything else to play. And I just played that song at the end. And people started crying and really connected to it. And a lot of people afterwards were like, I really loved that last song that you played. And started playing it a bit more. And I realized like, oh, this song is connecting more than all the ones that I, you know, was really going over and over and over and thought were the best ones. It became this kind of very unassuming little song that has now become kind of a centerpiece to the album and has become the title track. Started off as just this thing that I wrote in, you know, an afternoon.
So obviously there's no way of, you know, like you said, once you put it out in the world, it becomes something else. But it occurred to me that listening to the album, that this is the kind of thing I feel like I could keep around for a while because I think it's going to come in useful at different points in the future.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. You know, I wonder I'll rephrase what I was going to initially ask. I mean, obviously, you're such a music lover. You must have records like that in your life where it's like, oh, that was important. You know, Jeff Buckley's Grace. Oh, that was important to me at 15 for this reason. But at 25, it was much more so this reason.
Yeah, I think Crushing by Julia Jacklin is probably the one that caught me the most in the last few years. Fiona Apple, her second album, the one that has like a 42 word title. That song, when I heard that, I was about 23, and I remember just thinking, how is this not written for me? This feels like someone wrote this for me. I remember hearing Paper Bag and thinking, no, sorry, this is obviously a trick because somebody's written this album exactly for me. It's everything I'm going through. And that's one of the main albums that I will always go back to. It was a particular time in my life. It was a particular energy that I had, I guess, that was very, and felt like I learned from her, not just as a musician, but also as like an emotional being, I guess. I really felt like I learned a lot from that album.
You've been listening to a conversation with Alva Reddy. Her new album, Kiss Big, is out now. You can learn more about her and all her music at alvareddy.com. You can learn more about this podcast and all programming on our station by visiting our website, kmuw.org. Send us your questions and comments at info@kmuw.org and find all the latest programming notes on that website as well. Thanks again for listening. We'll see you next time. And before we go, it's always important to remind you that our theme music is composed and performed by Torin Anderson.